Those who are blind, have low vision, or have another print disability, which makes reading, holding a book, or turning a page difficult or impossible. The content is copyrighted by the respective publishers. For more information, please visit us on the web at nfradioreading.org.
Hello, this is Jackie, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the Sunday, November 30th, issue of the front section of the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Recycling batteries for the U.S. poisons Africans. The World Health Organization recognizes a blood level of 5 micrograms per deciliter as dangerous. Residents of Ojo, Nigeria, tested far beyond that. There's a photo, 4 color photos at the top of this article. The first photo is of a black man. I would say he's in his 30s. His level was 25 micrograms per deciliter. This man had a blood lead level 5 times as high as what is considered lead poisoning. Next to him is a photo of a very young school-aged boy, and that says this child's level was 3 times as high. Below him is another older man, this worker 4 times as high, and the photo to the left of that is a woman, this mother 4 times as high. In Africa's lead recycling capital, factories are poisoning people. We know because we tested them. Recycling Batteries for U.S. Poisons Africans by Peter Goodman, Will Fitzgibbon, and Samuel Granados. Poisonous dust falls from the sky over the town of Ojo near Lagos, Nigeria. It coats kitchen floors, vegetable gardens, churchyards, and schoolyards. The toxic soot billows from crude factories that recycle lead for American companies. With every breath, people inhale invisible lead particles and absorb them into their bloodstream. The metal seeps into their brains, wreaking havoc on their nervous systems. It damages livers and kidneys. Toddlers ingest the dust by crawling across floors, playgrounds, and in backyards, then putting their hands in their mouth. Lead is an essential element in car batteries, but mining and processing it is expensive. So companies have turned to recycling as a cheaper, seemingly sustainable source of this hazardous metal. As the United States tightened regulations on lead processing to protect Americans over the past 3 decades, finding domestic lead became a challenge. So the auto industry looked overseas to supplement its supply. In doing so, car and battery manufacturers pushed the health consequences of lead recycling onto countries where enforcement is lax, testing is rare, and workers are desperate for jobs. 70 people living near and working in factories around Ojo volunteered to have their blood tested by the New York Times and The Examination, a nonprofit newsroom that investigates global health. 7 out of 10 had harmful levels of lead. Every worker had been poisoned. More than half the children tested in Ojo had levels that could cause lifelong brain damage. Dust and soil samples showed lead levels up to 186 times as high as what is generally recognized as hazardous. More than 20,000 people live within a mile of Ojo's factories. Experts say the test results indicate that many of them are probably being poisoned. Lead poisoning worldwide is estimated to cause far more deaths each year than malaria and HIV/AIDS combined. It causes seizures, strokes, blindness, and lifelong intellectual disabilities. The World Health Organization makes clear that no level of lead in the body is safe. The poisoning of Ojibwe is representative of preventable public health disaster unfolding in communities across Africa. One factory's lead soot falls onto tomato and pineapple farms near a village in Togo. Another factory has contaminated a soccer field in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania's largest city. In Ghana, a recycler melts lead next door to a family's chicken coop. Factories in and around Ojibwe recycle more lead than anywhere else in Africa. The United States imported enough lead from Nigeria alone last year to make millions of batteries. Manufacturers that use Nigerian lead make batteries for major car makers and retailers such as Amazon, Lowe's, and Walmart. The auto industry touts battery recycling as an environmental success story. Lead from old batteries, when recycled cleanly and safely, can be melted down and reused again and again with minimal pollution. But companies have rejected proposals to use only lead that is certified as safely produced. Automakers have excluded lead from their environmental policies. Battery makers rely on the assurances of trading companies that lead is recycled cleanly. These intermediaries rely on perfunctory audits that make recommendations, not demands. The industry, in effect, built a global supply system in which everyone involved can say someone else is responsible for oversight. Nigeria is the economic engine of West Africa, and it is among the fastest-growing sources of recycled lead for American companies. Ojibwe and the communities nearby make up the heart of the industry, home to at least 7 lead recyclers. 2 factories are near boarding schools. Another faces a seminary. Others are surrounded by homes, hotels, and restaurants. Among the largest and dirtiest lead recyclers in Ojibwe is True Metals. It has supplied lead to factories that make batteries for Ford, General Motors, Tesla, and other automakers, records show. True Metals did not respond to questions about its practices or the lead test results. 4 years ago, Olwabuko Bakare was pregnant with her 5th child when she moved into a home in Ojibwe within sight of a battery recycling factory. The smoke seeped through the windows at night, making her family cough and leaving a black powder on their floor and food. "In the morning, when we looked outside, the ground seemed to be covered in charcoal," Ms. Bakare said. Testing revealed that her 5-year-old son Samuel had a blood level of 15 micrograms per deciliter, 3 times the level at which the World Health Organization recommends action. His 8-year-old brother, Israel, tested even higher. Ms. Bakare, 44, has worked inside battery recycling factories for years, cleaning toilets and sinks. Her test showed she had a lead level of 13.1 micrograms per deciliter, which is associated with complications including miscarriages and preterm birth. Now she wonders whether the smoke contributed to her son's premature birth at 7 months. To understand the extent of Ojibwe's contamination, consider what happened more than a decade ago in Vernon, California, the site of one of the worst cases of lead pollution in modern American history. Soil testing around a recycling plant revealed high lead levels, including at the nearby preschool. Officials called the area an environmental disaster. The factory closed. The cleanup continues today. Soil at the California preschool contained lead at 95 parts per million. In Ojibwe, soil at one school had more than 1,900 parts per million. All of this is avoidable. Lead batteries can indeed be recycled as cleanly as advertised. In Europe, experts say some recycling factories are spotless, but that requires millions of dollars in technology. Roger Mick said, the president of Battery Council International, an industry group, said that American manufacturers got 85% of their lead from recyclers in North America, where regulations are generally strict. As for the growing amount of overseas, he said his group condemns unacceptable practices and advises lead recyclers on how to improve conditions. But at the end of the day, Mr. Mixed said, it's up to regional and local governments and their regulators to enforce the laws in their countries. Most major car companies did not address the Times and Examination findings about tainted lead from Nigeria. Volkswagen and BMW said they would look into it. Subaru said it did not use recycled lead from anywhere in Africa. The test results, though, affirm years of research about the industry's toll in Africa. A 2010 study found widespread lead poisoning among workers at a recycler called Success Africa in Ghana. One employee's lead level was so high that doctors were surprised he was alive. Success Africa did not respond to requests for comment. Yet the factory stayed open and in recent years has sold lead to a battery supplier for BMW, Volkswagen, and Volvo. The Ghanaian Health Ministry recently found that 87% of children living near Success Africa had lead poisoning. In Ajiwo, recycling is a dirty, dangerous process. It begins with a dead battery. There are plenty. The United States sends tens of thousands of secondhand cars to Nigeria each year. A procession of vehicles arrives at a muddy yard in Lagos. These are the pickers who salvage and sell dead batteries. Then, workers known as breakers prepare the batteries to be recycled. They use machetes to hack into the plastic casings and drain the acid. These breakers work for the Good Luck Ijka 43. Today, he said, True Metals has called me 5 times. Mr. Ijka handles hundreds of batteries each day. Each night, laborers work in a sort of bucket brigade to load batteries for delivery to the factories. At these factories, known as smelters, lead from the batteries is melted and purified inside a furnace, then shaped into bars. This is the source of the poisonous smoke that drifts over Ajiwo. About a half hour away from True Metals, the king of Ajiwo, Kazim Kashimaro, sat atop a carved wooden throne and leaned back into red velvet cushions. I just want to close them all down, the king said. His subjects have complained for years about the factories, which sit among other metals plants. In surveys commissioned by the Times and the Examination, people reported common symptoms of lead poisoning: headaches, stomach aches, seizures, learning delays, and other neurological complaints. Residents recounted efforts to pressure the factories to improve, visits made, complaints lodged. As far back as 2018, the local newspaper, Business Day, wrote about lead pollution in Ajiwo. Factory managers often apologized and promised improvements, residents said. Sometimes the companies would string up electrical lines and add streetlights to make amends, but the pollution continued. Despite the king's exasperation, the real power resides with leaders in the capital, Abuja. The government always says, no, 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 just give them time. Let's get them to change, the king said. Besides, his subjects wanted the factories clean, not closed. Ajiwo is full of people who spend their days coaxing sustenance from meager opportunities. Children gather shreds of plastic that their mothers wash and sell to recyclers. Men squat in the dirt using rocks to split open old wiring to extract copper. Across Africa, governments have had little awareness of the harms of battery recycling, instead focusing on jobs and foreign investment, said Andreas Manhart, a senior researcher at Okio Institute, a German environmental organization. He has visited at least 20 African factories. We see investors coming in, setting up new substandard operations, he said, and every time this leaves a highly polluted site. As environmental regulations in the United States and Canada have driven dirty smelters out of business, buyers have searched the world for new suppliers. In recent years, companies in the United States have imported recycled from at least 8 countries in Africa. Because the supply chain is opaque and diffuse, car companies and battery makers are unlikely to know the precise origins of the lead they use. They rely on international trading companies to supply it. One such company, Trafigura, has sent recycled lead to U.S. companies from True Metals and 6 other Nigerian smelters in the past 4 years, records show. Last year, Trafigura reported $243 billion in revenue by trading oil, gas, and metals worldwide. Until recently, Trafigura's Nigerian suppliers included one factory, Green Recycling Industries, that tried to live up to its name. International experts from nonprofit research groups and the metals industry visited Green Recycling last year as part of an effort to strengthen Nigeria's weak inspection of battery recyclers. The country has laws to protect the environment, but struggles to enforce them. The experts marveled at Green Recycling's anti-pollution technology and the machinery that safely broke apart batteries, the sort of equipment featured in promotional videos by American battery makers. But operating cleanly put Green Recycling at a disadvantage. It had to make up for its high machinery cost by offering less money for dead batteries. Outbid by competitors with crude operations, Green Recycling had nothing to recycle. Ali Fawaz, the company's general manager, said his competitors were essentially making money by harming locals. "If killing people is okay, why would I not kill more and more?" he said. The company shut down this year. The Times and the Examination sought comments from all the recyclers. 2 responded. BPL Nigeria said it was making health, safety, and environmental improvements. "The evolution of industry practices requires time," the company said in a statement. Arnad Singh, a manager at another factory, African Nonferrous Industries, denied breaking any laws, but said that the company was making improvements nevertheless. "Compared to others in Nigeria, my company is the best," he said. In October, researchers gathered residents to disclose their test results. Anxious workers and parents lined up to speak to nurses and collect multivitamins and calcium tablets, which can limit lead absorption. But those treatments are just part of what experts recommend in lead poisoning cases. Generally speaking, the first thing doctors advise is to reduce exposure, cover or seal chipped lead paint, replace lead water pipes, put clean topsoil over contaminated dirt. There is no playbook for reducing exposure when people's homes are being sprinkled with lead dust from the sky. Thomas Eade said he didn't have the money to move. "I don't know the way out," he said. "There's nothing from the government. They're saying, just go away." The morning after he received the test results, Mr. Eade stepped outside the room that he shares with his 3 children, all of them sleeping together on a crumbling mattress. He looked past his clothesline toward True Metals. At the front gate stood 2 shipping containers, ready for their loads. You're listening to a reading of articles and features from the front section of the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Group is a gift still treasured after 44 years, by Catherine Rossman. The members of this impossible-to-get-into club have logged a combined 330 years of marriage. Among them, they count 15 children, 27 grandchildren, with one on the way, assorted professions, and innumerable tears shed, hands held, and assurances given that none of life's difficulties will be faced alone. In Long Island community centers and therapists' offices, they have met on about 880 occasions and talked, in the strictest confidence, for some 80,000 minutes about pacifiers and timeouts, about feeling overwhelmed by careers and feeling undervalued without them. They've discussed empty nests, dying parents, tensions with adult siblings, marital conflicts, parenting grown children, oh, the worry never stops, retirement, aging, illness, and even the death of one of their own. This is group, a generically named, remarkably devoted circle of friends. Group is six women, all in their 70s, and each married for half a century. They've been gathering on the second and fourth Tuesday of each month, minus July and August, for 44 years. Over 90 minutes, they share with one another and a paid facilitator their worries, struggles, and triumphs. It is not, clinically speaking, group therapy, but it is also not a social gathering. "We're not swapping recipes," said Miriam Kaslow, 74. "This is hard work." Dr. Kaslow, a retired physician, sat with other members on a recent afternoon to discuss the role that a group like Group can play in women's lives. They nestled close on an L-shaped couch at the Greenvale, New York home of one of the members. There was no music playing in the background. There were no snacks on the coffee table, and no one was looking at their phone. Their group did not start as an exercise in women's conscious raising, the sort of gathering that had been in vogue a decade earlier. This was unabashedly a family-raising effort built on the philosophy that the job of molding confident children and maintaining strong marriages is best done in community with other women walking the same path. But what began as an opportunity for young mothers and wives to learn how to best nurture their families became something bigger. Group is, a gift they gave themselves. Decades into an era of social media that has deadened the meaning of the word friend, these women present an undiluted example of the value of real-life, in-person, long-standing bonds. To understand the longevity and intensity of these relationships, rewind to 1981. That year, a counselor named June Azule was leading a Mommy and Me class for toddlers and their mothers at a local Jewish community center. When it ended, she asked some of the women if they would like to form a new sort of arrangement, meeting twice a month without children to share parenting strategies and concerns. Group was born. Within a few years, word of this tight-knit band of women had spread around the North Shore of Long Island. "People were jealous of it, obviously," Dr. Kaslow said. "But we have not accepted a new person in more than 35 years. We can't. We speak in shorthand." These were women who were asking, "How can I have a strong and healthy family without losing myself in those efforts? And how can I not do this in isolation?" Said Dr. Sandra Wolkoff, who served for about 15 years as Group's facilitator until 2019. From the beginning, members made Group a priority. Susan Stein, 74, said her husband knew he had to be home to watch the children every other Tuesday, and the children knew why. Mom has Group. "It became a ritual," she said. "There were no ifs, ands, or buts." The structure of the sessions has not changed over the decades. The facilitator leading Group, there have been three over the years, asks who has an issue to share. Sometimes the conversations revolve around family joy. Other times they work through woes. There is always laughter and often at least a few tears. Members say they walk out of every session feeling buttressed by emotional support and armed with practical solutions. You get five or six other people to look at the problem and a therapist to bring in context and research, says Joyce Bartolomo, 78. The women spent the early years discussing parenting strategies and the demands of marriage. When the little kids and their little problems grew bigger, drinking, teenage rebellion, depression, heartbreak, Group was there. "My advice lexicon developed, manage by fact. Do not let anxiety overtake decision-making. Don't write the script. Don't get ahead of yourself. And the self-explanatory count to 10 before you answer either your husband or your kids." The women had a rhythm for introducing new parenting tactics gleaned from Group on Tuesday nights. This involved trying to avoid letting their children know that the advice was group-sourced from Group. When was the best time to try out something new on their kids? Never on a Wednesday, one of the women explained at a recent meeting. It's hard to say who said this because often their words layer on top of one another. And even if you're sitting in the room with them, it can be hard to know who's saying what. If you did that, another said, your child would say, "Oh, good, Mom, you spoke to group." Group was an omnipresent fixture in the lives of their children. Stephanie Weiner, whose mother, Judy Marcus, is a member, said her childhood and college friends were aware of it, as are her adult friends. Group is like Madonna, said Mrs. Weiner, 42. Everyone knows about it, and it doesn't need a last name. Like my sisters. Before group, some of the women knew one another casually from the neighborhood or carpools. Some were strangers, but that was long ago. There is not an aspect of my life they don't know about, said Leslie Popkin, 73, one of the members. There's not an aspect of my life they haven't helped me through. When her daughter, Dory, struggled with an eating disorder as a teenager and was hospitalized, Miss Popkin turned to group for support. When the women bring up an issue, she said the routine response, "How can group help you with this?" She remembers clearly what she asked for. "You can remind me that I am not a bad mother," she said, she told them. "You can remind me that you're always here for me. You can remind me that Dory is going to get better and come through this." Ms. Popkin, a literacy coach and retired teacher, described the support she received as a web of interlocking hands that encircled her. "Group carried me," she said. Now that Dory Hyatt, at 47, is healthy and a mother of teenagers herself, she says she can appreciate how difficult her illness must have been for her mother. "I'm really glad she had group to help her," she said. Group has supported Sandy Lippman, 76, through breast cancer and the emotional hurdles that accompanied her retirement from her job as a technology specialist for a local school district. She has not been shy when her feelings have been hurt by the cliques that form. "Just like family, it can get messy," she said, "but we work it out." Then there is Ms. Marcus, 73, who helps manage her family's photography studio and is quick to place her hand on a friend's during a moment of vulnerability. Since moving from Long Island to New York City 21 years ago, she suffers through Long Island Expressway traffic two Tuesdays a month, a sign of her commitment. "There are other benefits for Judy, too," said Ms. Popkin, "because this lets her go to a whole other TJ Maxx." Miss Marcus once wanted to quit group, she said, after a disagreement with Ms. Popkin left her furious and hurt. But the others would not let her go. So she and Ms. Popkin worked it out in group. "This taught me a lot about forgiveness," Miss Marcus said, "and about not giving up on something that matters to me." Today, the women still discuss their children, the difficulties of knowing that their perspective might be valuable but not always welcome, and the feelings of being disconnected at times, particularly from adult sons who are busy with their own marriages, children, and careers. "They have their own nuclear family," said someone. This was one of the moments when they all talked at the same time, their voices melding into one. "And so I remind myself, so what if he doesn't call for a few weeks?" "She still doesn't believe that," another woman chimed in to universal laughter. "I bought him a mug that says, 'Don't forget to call your mother,'" one said. "At least his wife calls me," another added. Michael Lippman, Sandy's husband, says his wife has many friends and close relatives, but group support is singular. To watch them go from one chapter of their lives together to the next and the next, he said, "Well, it's very beautiful, and I'm not sure it can be easily replicated." Jamie Cooper, Joyce Bartolomeo's daughter, recalled feeling overwhelmed after having a child of her own. Her mother's advice to her was born of experience. "She reminded me that being a mom, a wife, a daughter, and a professional were not meant to be done alone. And once I found my people, like group, it would be entirely different," Ms. Cooper said. Like other daughters of group, she has tried, with only limited success, to recreate her mother's dynamic. The daughters now realize how unique their mother's commitment has been. Sasha Bruno, Erica's daughter, said she always felt proud of her mother's involvement in group, but never understood the power of the bonds until the summer of 2020. That was when she pulled up to her parents' home in Bayville during some of the most isolating days of the COVID-19 pandemic. and also about a year after her mother had been diagnosed with brain cancer, and saw six women on the lawn. It was group. They were hoisting signs painted with hearts as they yelled, "We love you," to her mother, who sat in a wheelchair on the porch. Erica died about 6 months later. Sasha now cares for her father as she raises her young son. For the past year, to help her cope with her grief and to look to her future, she's found support and solace every Wednesday night when she meets with a half a dozen others and a therapist to talk and to listen. "I guess," Sasha said, "that I'm carrying on my mother's tradition." You're listening to a reading of articles and features from the front section of the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Overnight attack pounds Kyiv for nearly 10 hours by Cassandra Vinograd and Oleksandr Chubko. Kyiv, Ukraine. Russia unleashed a nearly 10-hour air assault across Ukraine on Saturday, killing at least two people in the capital and injuring dozens more, according to the Ukrainian authorities. The attack, which involved dozens of Russian missiles and hundreds of drones, came as Trump administration officials were expected to meet with Ukrainian and Russian officials in the coming days as part of a diplomatic push to end the war. The Russian assault started just before midnight, with the capital Kyiv coming under the heaviest fire. The all-clear was given around 9:30 a.m. Under a thick white fog, emergency workers scrambled to respond to fires and tend to the wounded in seven districts of Kyiv. The city's mayor, Vitaly Klitschenko, said two people had been killed and at least 37 injured. A third person was killed outside the city. Many people in Kyiv were awakened by air raid warnings, then dragged on for hours. Margarita, 29, was in bed in the eastern part of the city when an explosion hit. She described seeing a flash of light, things falling on her, and blood pouring out. She spoke to a reporter in front of her damaged apartment building, her head wrapped in a bandage that covered four stitches. She asked that her last name not be used without giving a reason. Some Ukrainians are reluctant to give their full names out of fears for their safety or that of their loved ones still near the front line. The blast blew out her windows and peppered the walls of her ninth-floor corner apartment with shrapnel, she said. She had moved to Kyiv from the Donetsk region in eastern Ukraine to escape fierce fighting there. The sad irony of the Kyiv attack was not lost on her. "In the Donetsk region," she said, "I never got hit like this." As a crane hoisted rescuers to the higher floors of her building, some residents were already inside sweeping glass from their charred apartments. Others lined up in the street for hot tea and plastic sheeting from aid groups to cover their windows. Many were unsure if a drone or a missile had hit. Sheared off trees and a crater and a small patch of greenery were visible in front of the building, along with the shell of a car on the road beyond it. Andriy Sybha, Ukraine's foreign minister, noted that the assault came as the Trump administration was trying to maintain momentum in the peace talks. "While everyone is discussing points of peace plans, Russia continues to pursue its war plan of 2 points, to kill and destroy," Mr. Sybha wrote on X. President Volodymyr Zelensky of Ukraine said Russia had targeted energy infrastructure and civilian facilities in the sweeping attack, which involved 36 missiles and nearly 600 drones. More than 600,000 consumers were without power in Kyiv and the surrounding region on Saturday morning, according to the country's energy ministry. When Mr. Zelensky later announced that a Ukrainian delegation was en route to the United States to swiftly and substantially work out the steps needed to end the war, rescue efforts at the nine-story apartment building in Kyiv were winding down. Soot-covered firefighters perched on their truck. Residents carrying sheets of plywood climbed stairwells still draped with fire hoses. Irina, 42, who did not give her last name, said she was unsure if she and her husband would be able to stay that night in their apartment, where broken glass covered every surface and the smell of smoke was overpowering. They had gone to a basement shelter just 10 minutes before the blast, she said. Even there, she said it was very loud and hard to breathe with all the smoke and dust. But the couple knew they were lucky. The shelter, they noted, was only set up a few weeks ago. Without it, the toll could have been far worse. Applications for asylum are paused by Trump, by Hamed El-Aziz and Edward Wong. The United States on Friday paused all asylum decisions and stopped issuing visas to people from Afghanistan as President Trump launched a major review of the country's immigration system after the shooting of two National Guard members. Joseph Edlau, the director of U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, said in a statement that his agency had halted all asylum decisions until we can ensure that every alien is vetted and screened to the maximum degree possible. Mr. Trump cut the number of asylum claims dramatically by moving to seal the southern border when he took office. Friday's decision affects people who already are in the United States and believe they would face persecution if they returned to their home country. The State Department also announced on Friday night that it was halting visas for Afghans, including those who had helped in the United States during the war in their country. The decisions come as Mr. Trump steps up his anti-immigration policies after a gunman, identified by the authorities as an Afghan national, shot two members of the National Guard on Wednesday in Washington, just blocks from the White House. The suspect, 29-year-old Ramala Lakhanwal, entered the United States through a temporary program set up to manage the immigration of Afghan nationals fleeing Taliban rule. He obtained asylum in April, according to three people with knowledge of the case who were not authorized to speak publicly. The State Department formally instructed its diplomats to stop processing all immigrant and non-immigrant visas for Afghan passport holders, according to a copy of a cable obtained by the New York Times. Diplomats are supposed to conduct any scheduled visa interviews, but not grant the visas. If visas have been approved and printed, but not handed to the applicant, diplomats should destroy the printed visas, the cable says. The order by Secretary of State Marco Rubio freezes the special immigrant visa program for Afghans, which had been set up for people who had helped out the U.S. military and government in the war. All applicants had undergone official vetting. As the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan grew closer in 2021, a bipartisan coalition of lawmakers had pushed to expedite special immigrant visas for those who had helped the Americans. Afghans entering the United States under that program or as refugees all went through a rigorous vetting process. The ones with special immigrant visas got green cards after arriving. It appears Secretary Rubio is attempting to shut down the Afghan Special Immigrant Visa Program in direct violation of federal law and standing court orders, Sean Van Dever, the head of Afghan EVAC, a group that tries to resettle Afghans in the United States, said in a statement. Our hearts are absolutely broken for our Afghan allies, who have already endured more trauma, loss, and sacrifice than most Americans can imagine. Afghan refugee applications had been frozen months earlier in a blanket refugee ban. Mr. Trump then issued a travel ban in June on 19 countries that included Afghanistan, but there has been an exception for applicants for special immigrant visas. With this latest action, the final legal entrance for Afghans outside the United States has been closed. In recent days, officials also announced that they were reviewing green cards given to people from countries banned from travel to the United States by the administration, pausing all immigration applications from Afghan immigrants and beginning a review of asylum requests granted during the Biden administration. The protection of this country and of the American people remains paramount, and the American people will not bear the cost of the prior administration's reckless resettlement policies, Mr. Edlau wrote on social media in announcing the Green Card review on Thursday. American safety is non-negotiable. The asylum system in the United States has long experienced backlogs. As USCIS border became overwhelmed by border crossings in recent years, applications for asylum filed inside the United States grew. A July 2024 report by the Homeland Security Department's Inspector General found that at the end of 2023 fiscal year, USCIS had more than 1 million asylum cases pending determination. Semaglutide fails to quell Alzheimer's, studies show, by Gina Collada. Hopes were high, in retrospect, perhaps too high. On Monday, Novo Nordisk announced that two large studies failed to find any effect of the drug semaglutide on cognition and functioning in people with mild cognitive impairment, an early stage of Alzheimer's, or with dementia. The participants were randomly assigned to take a pill of semaglutide, the compound at the heart of the weight loss injections Ozempic and Wegovy, or a placebo for 2 years. Today, we announced that our efforts to slow down the progression of Alzheimer's disease has come to an end, said Maziar Mike Dustar, chief executive at Novo Nordisk, in a video posted on LinkedIn. He added, "Based on the indicative data points we had, this is not the outcome we had hoped for." The studies, involving 1,855 people in one trial and 1,953 in the other, seemed to stem an initial phase of optimism. The drugs appeared miraculous in their treatment of obesity, diabetes, heart disease, and kidney disease. Alzheimer's and other brain illnesses looked like the next frontier. But there had been other recent warnings in two smaller studies of brain diseases. One, done by researchers in Britain, asked if a similar drug could help with Parkinson's disease. That drug had no effect. Another study found that semaglutide did not help with cognitive impairment in people with major depression, a severe form of the disease. The company will present more results from its Alzheimer's study at a conference on Wednesday. Novo Nordisk's stock was down nearly 6% on Monday, deepening a month-long slump for the once surging company. We always knew there would be a low likelihood of success, but it was important to determine if semaglutide could take on one of the medicine's most challenging frontiers, Mr. Dustar said. Some Alzheimer's specialists, like Dr. John Morris, a professor of neurology at Washington University in St. Louis, said that from the start they had not been optimistic that semaglutide would work in Alzheimer's. He and others wondered, why might it work? A starting hypothesis was that the drugs might reduce inflammation, which occurs in Alzheimer's disease. There is no question that neuroinflammation is deleterious, Dr. Morris said. Yet he noted it might be difficult to quell it in Alzheimer's. A quarter century ago, researchers had tried giving anti-inflammatory drugs to patients with Alzheimer's, and they did not help, Dr. Morris said. The only way to really know was to perform the research Novo Nordisk did in a placebo-controlled study. In explaining why it had tested the hypotheses, the company pointed to the real-world evidence studies, preclinical models, as well as post-hoc analysis from diabetes and obesity trials. It did not cite specific studies, but among the real-world evidence studies is one that examined the electronic health records of 116 million patients. It found that those who were taking semaglutide for diabetes were 40 to 70% less likely to be diagnosed with Alzheimer's than those taking other diabetes medications. Another such study, involving Veterans Affairs records for patients with diabetes, found that semaglutide seemed to help with a wide variety of disorders, including brain-related conditions. For some researchers, there was a lesson here about how doctors and the general public sometimes seize upon studies that generate a hypothesis, then assume that they are offering proof. In the case of the studies of people taking semaglutide for diabetes, those subjects are likely to have been different from those taking other diabetes drugs. Investigators try to control for such differences, but they can control only for the ones they know. The annals of medicine are replete with observational studies that seem to prove a treatment was effective, only to have it fall in more rigorous studies. The research was motivated by studies with mice. One study in mice with an Alzheimer's-like disease found that semaglutide could improve memory and increase the number of neurons in the mice that were part of the study. But mice do not naturally get Alzheimer's, so the study is in effect an artificial construct. The results from study after study, all pointing to hope for semaglutide and Alzheimer's, were what might now appear to be irrational exuberance. You're listening to a reading of articles and features from the front section of the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Trapped as Towers Burned, How It Felt, by Anjali Tsui, Hong Kong. William Lee, a 40-year-old father of two, had no idea there was a fire ripping through his building when it started on Wednesday afternoon. There were no fire alarms and no signs of smoke inside his third-story apartment. Then he got a call from his wife, who heard about the blaze while she was at work. "You need to go," she said. We spoke by phone after he was released following 2 days in a hospital. The interview, conducted in Cantonese, has been condensed and edited for clarity. "It was my day off. I wasn't feeling well, so I was home. At 3:02 p.m., I got a call from my wife. She wasn't very nervous. She just said, 'There's a fire. You need to go.' I didn't think it was very serious. There was no fire alarm. I couldn't smell smoke. I took a few minutes to change and prepare to leave the apartment. When I opened the door, the smoke rushed in. My first reaction was to shut the door right away. I called my wife back to say I couldn't leave. That's when she started crying uncontrollably. I got some towels and used them to block the gap under the doors. I was pacing around my home looking for things when I heard voices coming from the corridors. I covered my mouth with a damp piece of cloth and rushed out. After just a minute, my throat was stinging and my eyes were watering uncontrollably. The hallway was pitch dark. I tried turning on my phone's flashlight, but it didn't make a difference. I walked toward the voices and found a couple in their 60s. I led them through the smoke back to my apartment, using the wall to trace my steps. 'Why were you there?' I asked them. 'Were there other people in the corridor?' They explained that the window in their unit had burst into flames, so they rushed out into the hallway. There, they heard a domestic worker calling out for an elderly woman she was caring for. Then suddenly, the voice stopped. After living here for 40 years, I know the building's layout well. There are two sets of staircases on every floor. One goes down to the lobby, and there's another set of back stairs. My neighbors said the back door was usually locked. My wife, who was now standing in the front of the building, said the lobby was already engulfed in flames. My friends told me to call the police. I called 999, and they transferred me to the firefighters. I told them what floor I was on and in which unit. They said, 'Okay, we'll arrange for someone to come and rescue you.' I started to smell the smoke and the stench of something burning. The couple who had been resting in my bedroom came outside and said the polystyrene foam surrounding the window had caught fire. At that moment, I really thought I might die. I share a bedroom with my wife and two kids. There are three mattresses in there and lots of blankets. I knew that if the windows burst, the fire would spread quickly. I started calling and texting my friends on WhatsApp to say goodbye. I told them to help me look out for my family. We started flashing our lights at the firefighters and caught their attention. I pointed to the window that was on fire. They immediately directed the fire hoses out the window and put out the fire. At first, they struggled to get the fire ladder to our unit. The scaffolding was in the way, and debris was falling from higher floors. A little after 5 p.m., they finally got to our window. The woman told me to go first, but I said, "No, you go first. I'm younger." She was rescued first, then her husband. For a few minutes, I was waiting alone in the apartment. It felt really somber. I looked around to see what I could take with me. I wanted to bring everything, but I couldn't bring anything. I grabbed my wife's watch and some cash and stuffed them into my bag. I rushed outside and climbed onto the ladder. The firefighter told me to crouch down and hold my head down because of the falling debris. Once I was on the ladder, I felt like time slowed. I was sad to leave my home behind. I was drenched from the fire hoses and I felt very cold. It felt like the sky was falling. Everything I owned was turning to dust. I felt a rush of emotions. Once I got down to the ground, the firefighters put us to one side and gave us some Pocari, a sports drink. I went to buy some new clothes and reunited with my family. My kids were crying a lot. All their toys were gone. Reviving a Maligned Concept Amid a Housing Crisis by Mihir Zaveri. Single-room apartments once symbolized everything wrong with New York City. They did not have private kitchens or bathrooms and were seen as cheap places where crime festered, drugs flourished, and the poor suffered daily indignities. Today, city officials say the solution to the housing crisis involves building a lot more of them. Councilman Eric Botcher, a Democrat who represents parts of Manhattan, introduced a bill on Tuesday that would allow the construction of new single-room occupancy apartments as small as 100 square feet for the first time in decades. The legislation, backed by the Department of Housing Preservation and Development, would make it easier to convert office buildings into these types of homes, also known as SROs. The apartments can resemble dormitories or suites and could become cheaper housing options in one of the most expensive cities in the world. "We're trying to make housing more affordable and create more supply," said Ahmed Tighani, the acting commissioner of the Housing Department. Such apartments, where kitchens and bathrooms are often shared, can cost $1,500 or less in neighborhoods like Bedford-Stuyvesant and Clinton Hill, where median rents easily exceed $3,000 a month. The push underscores how an extreme shortage of housing has led to a turnaround in attitude towards forms of shared housing, which have long been a controversial feature of cities worldwide. Cities like London, Zurich, and Seoul, with a thirst for cheap homes, are exploring similar ideas, as are other places in the U.S. Other cities, like Hong Kong, still struggle to make the homes livable. Few cities, though, have their histories as intertwined with these types of homes as New York. A population boom in the first half of the 20th century led to thousands of people cramming into flop houses, boarding houses, and SROs. There are about 30,000 to 40,000 left, down from more than 100,000 in New York City in the early 20th century, according to a 2018 study from the NYU Furman Center. But the homes became associated with poverty, overcrowding, and unsanitary conditions. The city passed laws preventing the construction of new units and the division of apartment buildings into SROs, leading to their steady decline over the decades. Overcrowding, overcharging, and the creation of disease and crime-breeding slums have been the direct result of this conversion practice, Mayor Robert Wagner said in 1954 when signing one of these bills. An advisor to a city council committee said at the time that the growth in SROs would reduce New York City to cubicle room living. In some ways, that is now part of the idea. The obvious benefit, city officials said, is that SROs and other shared housing would be cheap, but they might also be better match the city's changing demographics. The number of single-person households grew almost 9% from 2018 to 2023, city officials said. The number of households with people living together who are not family, for example, roommates, grew more than 11% over the same time period. Because of the housing shortage, many people end up joining together to rent bigger homes better suited for families, said Michael Sandler, the Housing Department's Associate Commissioner of Neighborhood Strategies. Building new shared housing might free up those apartments. He said that there were a number of companies today that marketed themselves as co-living providers that operated in a gray, unregulated legal area. For example, they may own a building or a few units and rent out individual rooms to people in a shared suite, but tenants do not have real leases and are not allowed by city regulations to do routine things like place locks on bedroom doors. The new legislation would also improve certain safety standards for shared housing, such as allowing only up to 3 apartments per kitchen or per bathroom, Mr. Sandler said. It would require shared housing to have sprinklers and provide enough electricity per room to run small appliances. Allowing new shared housing could help provide new living opportunities for young single people, people experiencing homelessness, and older people, and people just moving into the city, they said. These are not yesterday's SROs, Mr. Botcher said. They're modern, flexible, well-managed homes that can meet the needs of a diverse population. Still, single-room occupancy housing may not be a panacea, said Paul Freitag, the executive director of the Westside Federation for Senior and Supportive Housing, a nonprofit that runs a shelter in 3 SRO buildings on the Upper West that were built before the laws changed years ago. He said they were not ideal for older people who might not want to share bathrooms and might find the cramped space hard to move around in. Mr. Freitag said that people often stayed in shelters longer to find one-bedroom or studio apartments rather than move into SROs. His group is looking to convert its existing SRO building into bigger apartments. I think it's a very challenging setting in which to age, he said. You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the Sunday, November 30th issue of the front section of the New York Times. We read from the front section of the New York Times every Sunday at 1 p.m. Your reader has been Jackie. Thank you for listening.
Coming up next in the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service, we have a reading of the New York Times opinion page. Following that at 3 o'clock, the New York Times Arts and Leisure. And at 4 o'clock, a rebroadcast of this morning's Buffalo News. Radio Reading mails out a large print program schedule to our listeners every other month. If you have not received a Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service large print program schedule in the mail, please call us at 716-821-5555. We will make sure that you receive one every other month. A Braille version of the schedule is also available upon request. Our number again is 716-821-5555. Thank you. following program is intended for listeners who are blind, have low